So today, what vitals are we gonna take? Well, it's gonna be robots. I'll do the reveal right from the start. In our Celestinus podcast, we love robots. We love artificial intelligence, and we also love natural intelligence, and a great combination of artificial and natural, of robots and men. Is Steve, Steve Pinto, who is the CEO of Control Robotics, that actually, when you meet robots, like service robots, real robots in hospitals, next time you decide to spend some time there, it could be his robots that will be bringing you medicine, drugs, will be cleaning the floors, and maybe will be assisting you quite soon. So, Steve, it's my pleasure to welcome you to another episode of Venture Vitals, which is a podcast by Celestinus. Celestinus, the global health tech incubator, where we help startups who are into healthcare and technology and data grow and make it big around the world. So it's a pleasure to have you. And I'll go straight into this. So, why robots? How did this started?
Okay, well, thanks very much for having me. It is a bit of an odd question to, it's a bit of an odd answer, rather, not an odd question. It's a very, simple answer. Why robots? Well, I could give you the answer to say, I watched a lot of cartoons when I was a kid, and I loved the ones with all the robots in them. I could tell you that, there's the economical impact of what robotics and automation will have over the next 20 to 50 years, and, we wanted to be a part of that. I could tell you a funny anecdote about, why the machines kind of felt and found their way into my life. But, the truth of the matter is that about 5, 6 years ago, I was running another tech company in the VR space, and I was, working on a couple of different businesses, and I was helping other startups, in the space. And I've been in tech and tech entrepreneurship for over a decade. So I'd sort of accrued, a nice, well-rounded network of people. One of the engineers in my company was a really good friend of mine as well, and we were doing some really good, work together. And we got this opportunity to take on this really exciting project to automate a hotel. And, we jumped right into it because we thought this was something exciting. We wanted to do something really impactful. It was going to be the first automated hotel of any kind on the continent. We were doing this in South Africa at the time. And we jumped right in, and we started to work on this project with this customer, and they were super passionate about the, the objective, and they wanted to do something really big and bold and innovative, and they wanted to do room service, and they wanted to have customer interactions, and they wanted to help with cleaning services, and they wanted to do all these things to help their staff be a little bit more productive and create consistency within their business. So we rose to that challenge, and we said, well, we want to do this. We want to tackle this on. And we worked on this project for almost a year, and we realized that it was just far too much pain to try to automate this business. Like, there was just the technology and the software did not exist to build the solutions that this customer wanted. And while we could find robots from different manufacturers that could achieve some of these tasks, they didn't talk to each other. They didn't have simple interfaces. They weren't able to create custom workflows. There was just everything that the customer wanted, these machines couldn't do. And we realized that this was actually the biggest opportunity in the space, is that we needed to build tools so that people who didn't write code and who weren't engineers and weren't roboticists could actually build workflows, because they were operators. They were people who knew how their businesses worked, and they knew what they were trying to improve, but they just didn't have the tools to do it. And that's where we started Control. We had this vision right there to make our lives easier, after this painful project of a year of, absolute grind and toil. And, we lost money on that project at the end of the day. And we realized that this was just never going to make the robotics industry move forward if we couldn't make the tools and make this so much easier. So our mission was to make it as easy for anyone to automate their business in an hour or less, right? We wanted to remove all the friction around this and have the ability for anybody to pick and choose whatever robots they want, to build whatever workflows they want, to create their custom interactions with their staff and their users and their customers, and just create a full stack platform that made it easy for anyone to automate anything. And that's sort of where we started, you know. And from there, the journey's evolved into, you know, all different kinds of industries and all different opportunities. You know, we've met with all different kinds of customers all across the world, and we've realized that ultimately, people just need tools. And when they have the tools, they can build whatever it is that they want.
Exciting story, Steve. It's Evgeny Shvarov joining Tomas in our Celestinos podcast, Venture Vitals. So, yeah, I'm really curious how much robots in control robotics, and I mean, do you like produce robots now? Do you work with any kind of robots? What kind of company you are? Like a software company or hardware now, or like both? Tell us,
You know,
please.
thanks, Evgeny. That's a really good question, and it's good to see you. We kind of started the journey not wanting to be a hardware company, rather to be that middle layer of software. You know, we aspire to be something like Microsoft, you know, living on a whole bunch of different manufactured products and trying to, you know, stick the industry together and lean on the engineers and the companies that were building all this great hardware. And that's where we started, and that's, you know, sort of where we are still today. We have over 25 different robots you can pick and choose from now on our platform. And we're starting to realize that, you know, that is the opportunity, right? There are lots of robotics companies out there all trying to do different things, but there's no unified focus, and the tools don't exist for it to really build the custom workflows that you want. So we worked with, and we still work with, over six different manufacturers right now, from cleaning to delivery to, you know, to customer service and even like a bit of manufacturing. And we are starting to realize that there are still some gaps in what the manufacturers produce and the industries they service. So, you know, later this year, we're going to be exploring and, you know, releasing a dedicated range of machines just purposely built for healthcare. Because, you know, you can't really take a robot from a hotel and then put it in a hospital. It doesn't meet the same requirements. It doesn't meet the same, you know, needs of the customer. So, you know, we started on this journey being a software-only company, but we are sort of moving into doing some hardware ourselves and some products ourselves, specifically dedicated to the problems that we've identified that have the biggest potential for, you know, for upside. But yes, right now, Control is exclusively a software company, and we do make hardware to control elevators and to control doors and sensors and buttons and all kinds of peripherals, IoT devices that sort of build the smart building so that the robots can operate inside of them. But later this year, we're going to start releasing products that are dedicated purely just to healthcare because we see a very big gap that needs to be, you know, serviced.
Well, thanks for an outline of what you focus on and what you will be focusing on in the future. So, healthcare, again, why healthcare? Is it you mentioned you try to automate a hotel, which is like a hospitality quite close to to hospitals. You
In a
know,
way.
that's maybe you thought, well, where else in the hospitality sector could we move apart from hotels? Well, hospitality, how about hospitals? So probably
The
that was
next junction.
yeah, nice junction. We had it in front of our eyes all the time. We just couldn't see it. But really, why do you believe that hospitals have a future for robots? And there is a question that came to my mind when I listened to you. Getting excited about automation and let's automate everything. This is maybe a bad question because people tend to avoid it, which is, isn't there anything that we lose by automating everything? Isn't there something that we're replacing people, of course, who are busy and et cetera, there are no people in fact, et cetera. But is there an element that by automating a particular job or a particular service, you lose something that maybe was there, and just our obsession with efficiency and automation kind of tends to forget that there's stuff that we are losing. You know, the same is like with my mobile phone and with artificial intelligence. Of course, it's great. It's it makes you look more intelligent sometimes, but I think most of us would agree that we are losing something.
Yes, you're 100% right. I do agree with you. You know, I love artificial intelligence. We use it every day. You know, our company is underpinned by, you know, effectively physical or embedded AI, you know, real AI that's moving around and effectively doing tasks every day. But I actually don't like AI in some industries. Like, I don't like AI making imagery. I don't like AI making music. I don't like AI, you know, creating art. These are the things which I feel we have enough people in the world to make that kind of content, and we don't really need to replace them. You know, this is something that humans should have, you know, protected and curated, and we should have kept to the arts, to ourselves. You know, at the end of the day, packing boxes, moving boxes, cleaning floors, these are jobs that most people don't want to do in any case. You know, automating those is not a problem, you know, because they're not meaningful employment per se. And I'll get to that in a moment, but let's take a few steps back and let me tell you why hospitals specifically was something that, you know, we're doubling down into. You know, healthcare is one of these basic human rights, right? We all deserve healthcare. We all deserve efficient and effective and, you know, cost-effective healthcare. And unfortunately, you know, healthcare is subjected to a lot of external factors, and it's very important to empathize with the fact that healthcare practitioners and professionals can never really stop for long enough to change or fix anything. You know, you can't turn a hospital off. You can't stop, you know, operations for a week or two. You know, it's a 24/7 operation, 365, and you have people's lives in front of you. So everything is critical that needs to be done. And subsequently, hospitals move very, very slowly. You know, we've spent a lot of time in hospitals all over the world and looked from, you know, the most advanced cutting edge hospitals like the Mayo Clinic, you know, Vanderbilt, to the, you know, the sort of the cream of the crop, all the way down to, you know, community-led, you know, government hospitals in Africa. And we realized that everybody there is very passionate about patients and patient outcomes, right? And trying to help and save people's lives. But the tools that they use every day are archaic and, you know, belong in the dinosaur era, right? Like, most hospitals still run on pen and paper, right? They don't use automation to the full extent that they could. Even going deep into what, you know, InterSystems provides through Iris, looking at how much data is there and how much of that data is actually being used for something meaningful is so big and wide. And you realize that hospitals desperately need more tools and more, you know, sort of pieces of power to improve patient outcome and to reduce stress and fatigue on the staff that are there. Because a lot of people do it for the love of, you know, of health and recovery and, you know, making a positive impact on the world. It's not so much of a profit-driven exercise. And we realized that, you know, hospitals are a very unique operation as well. They're very similar to like a warehouse, like an Amazon warehouse. You know, they move thousands and thousands of items every single day. If you have a hospital that is 600 beds, you know, that's 600 patients, you're going to be producing 600 meals three times a day. That's, you know, almost 2,000 meals. You're going to be sending patients, you know, sometimes between 8 to 20 to 25 different, you know, prescription medication over the day. That's thousands of items, you know, all the waste that needs to be moved, all the linen that needs to be moved, everything that moves. It's tens of thousands of pounds of equipment and, you know, consumables, medicines, drugs. It's a full operation. There are hundreds of people who work in a hospital just moving things around all day, and they do it in the most inefficient way possible, usually run by pen and paper. They're basically Amazon warehouses, but instead of it being one floor, it's multiple floors and multiple challenges. And you have a time-sensitive, critical situation where you have people's lives on the line. So it's one of the industries that desperately needs automation, but also ones that has a positive impact on it. So we realized that if we made hospitals better, even just a few percent better, that compounding effect would make patients' outcomes better. It would make the health practitioners' lives better. And all the statistics we're seeing around the world is that there's just more and more and more of a gap and a shortage of the number of healthcare professionals that are going to exist in the workplace in the next 10 to 20 years. So you have to be able to provide them tools so that they can get the most out of their day. Otherwise, we're going to have a crisis on our hands where there's just not enough staff to support all the people who need healthcare. So we found it as a mission to, you know, to alleviate some of the bottlenecks and the problems and try to give tools to the staff who run in hospitals. And ultimately, at the end of the day, if we can make hospitals work even just slightly better, the compounding effect is that people can get healthier faster and they can recover better and staff can be happier in the workplace. And that just translates to a great environment. You know, I could help you get your Amazon package in, 3 hours less, but that's not going to save your life, is it? Right? That's just going to make you a little bit happier. So we've really focused our attention on how do we take this technology that exists in, healthcare, in, sorry, in manufacturing, in logistics, the stuff that lives in an Amazon warehouse, for example. How do we take that technology? How do we take those approaches? How do we bring that to industries with maximum impact? Healthcare is so underutilized in terms of what technology can really do. We saw it as a great opportunity and a really good mission to fulfill. So that's, a big reason why we're in hospitals, right? There's a huge logistical challenge and there's a great, positive impact if you can fix that problem, specifically for the staff and for the patients. And then to your second question, where does AI belong and what is, the positive impact of, automation? I think it's important to realize that like in the last 150 years, the world has moved very, very, very quickly in a very different way. 150 years ago, majority of the world's population were in agriculture. They were working in farms. This is, even 80% of Americans in, the turn of the century were farmers, right? And it doesn't mean that 80% of Americans don't have a job today. It means that their jobs have changed, right? People have evolved because the workplace has evolved. The tractors, the automation that brought into agriculture made the cost of food reduced dramatically and it changed the food scarcity, within 100 years. All those people who used to be farmers moved into becoming engineers and to doctors and to, electricians and so on and so on. The workplace changed, but it changed over two or three generations. So it was easier for humanity to adapt to that rapid change. Now, because of AI, we're seeing people's jobs pretty much not exist before they even finish university studying it. People are entering the first year of university, and by the time they leave, their job is somewhat irrelevant because AI is able to do it. And that's fundamentally quite scary. I can understand and empathize with people who are very scared about, their jobs on the line and, effectively their security and their safety and their lives. And, are they going to be able to support themselves if a machine can do their job 10 times better than they can? But I think it's very important to distinguish the difference between tasks and a job. You guys have jobs, I have a job, everybody has a job. But a job is a collection of tasks, right? I don't do one thing every single day because if I did that one thing every single day, a machine would have taken my job 10 years ago. It's a collection of tasks that I'm responsible for. And some of those tasks are very meaningful and important, and some of those tasks are less meaningful and less important. What we need to be doing is if we want to change the way that labor is perceived and the way that we reimburse and pay people for their time, we have to remove the meaningless tasks and give them more time to do the meaningful tasks. For example, we talk about hospitals. If you're a pharmacist or you're a pharmacist technician or you're working in the pharmacy, there are many, many jobs that is critically important. Dispensing drugs, stock control, making sure the patients are getting, the correct medication at the right time. Those are meaningful, hours of your day spent well. What's not meaningful is you pushing a trolley, right? And pushing a trolley a kilometer, to go somewhere and back and take an hour to do a task just by pushing a trolley is not a meaningful task. The trolley should drive itself, right? This is where we should be. If we want to be able to improve people's income and pay them more and pay them more meaningfully for their time, we have to change the types of tasks that they do, and effectively, we have to change the jobs that they do. So I think it's very important that we look to automate from the bottom up, not from the top down. We spoke about, art and sort of, operations that generative AI is starting to take away from people. These are top-down approaches, right? These are the jobs that live on the top of the spectrum. We don't need to necessarily automate that. What we do need to automate are the things from the bottom up, right? The cleaning, the boxes moving, the basic operations, the heavy lifting, the strenuous work. These are things which AI and robots, machines, and automation can create positive impacts in the world. It's very important to remember that robots are deflationary, right? Robots cost less and less over time. Technology becomes cheaper over time. So if we want to produce things for cheaper amounts in the future, if we want to reduce inflation in certain types of markets, you need to automate. It's the only way to do it. And the best way to do that is to automate some of the basic costs, the lower functioning tasks of our day-to-day lives down with automation, and then prioritize more of our time into more meaningful tasks that we can get better remuneration for. This is the shift that we need to have in the workplace. We need to stop thinking that this machine that doesn't have arms or legs, or the ability to communicate effectively is going to replace me. No, it's going to replace a task that you did. And you have 9 other tasks, or 10 other tasks, or 20 other tasks to do. And those need more of your time and your attention. Because if you spend more time and attention there, your job is more important, and subsequently, you are more relevant in the workplace. So there needs to be a shift in the way we think about jobs and tasks, and getting robots to do tasks, not jobs.
Wow. Steve, this was a very insightful speech, touching so many topics. Great, and I hope this will be insightful for our audience. But you even touched the most overhyped, okay, just hyped the topic about AI agents. And actually, what you really do is also that kind of about agents, but the real agents, like a moving agents, like physical ones. Yes. And why you mentioned that the you also have some devices that help you with elevators and something like that. I have a question regarding this, because I felt that it's not easy to make robots like survive in the human environment, like in all this buildings and star and such things. So I heard that might be one of the most common problems with elevators, that robots, it's just very difficult for a robot to use elevator, just like
That's
to
right.
move between story levels. So can you share anything, like any story that you've faced an implementation moving agents like robots into like human environments? Any like what's the most maybe the most difficult, most funny moments?
Yeah, so that's a very, very good point. And this is actually the biggest problem in the adoption of service robots in the industry, the elevators. The elevator is a very difficult problem to solve, because there's many different layers to this problem. One is that the technology is incredibly expensive, by design. It's designed to be very expensive. It's designed to break constantly. It's designed to continually cost money to service and maintain. This is the industry's practices, regardless of which company it is. Nobody is building a reliable elevator that never breaks and never stops and never has an issue, right? It's not part of the operation. The second thing is that there is no interface that you would assume, right? Most of the elevators that you're going to take today will cost $1 million, and will have the compute capacity of, a $100 Android phone from 5 years ago, right? This is just the nature of these types of products. The way that elevators are designed are, to be as fundamentally simple as possible, so that they can operate as, many times a day as they can. But they are moving heavy weights. There's a lot of safety restrictions or requirements. There's a lot of challenges around building elevators. I'm not saying that, this is a completely incestuous industry that everyone's trying to rip everyone off. It's not an easy industry. There's a lot of challenges externally and internally. But elevators are not built for robots. Right. Unfortunately, robots don't have fingers most of the time, unless we're humanoids, and we're still, just a few years away from making those, commonplace in the workplace. But you want to be able to send something simple, like an API call, just to say, "Hey, I want to go to floor 5. Take me to floor 5." But because that elevator is built on a technology from 1985, it doesn't have an API. It doesn't have an Ethernet port. It doesn't have, an IoT device. And for it to be updated means that, the elevator company has to basically rebuild, a whole piece of their technology. And then, while we've solved some problems with making, easy interfaces and controllers that, are IoT enabled and run, certain sort of compute modules on the device, so that it actually is a modernized approach, there's no open interface. Everything is locked up in walled gardens, right? So you want to, use a simple interface to send a 485 signal, or a 232 signal, whatever it is that you want to just, send an instruction. but it's completely blocked by proprietary systems and software, so it's not easy for you to work with. You know, it's a bit of a gamble to say, you know, you go to a hospital or a hotel or whatever business that you're looking at, and that elevator is modern enough that you can communicate with it, that the company is, you know, open to collaboration, and that it doesn't cost you an arm and a leg to actually do this. You know, we've seen an elevator, you know, integration, as we call it, cost $40,000. And we've seen it cost $5,000, and we've seen it also cost $1,000, right? There's a whole spectrum of these things. And it is probably the biggest problem in software, sorry, in robotics adoption, is that if you can't get these machines to traverse the floors, then they're not very useful, right? Like, you don't want to put a robot on every single floor. You want to be able to make them move around the building just as humans do. Because I think it's very important that we're not trying to automate an entire hospital so that there's no more people in it, right? That's not our objective. Our objective is to create a hybrid workforce where people and machines work in the same space and create the most efficient environment possible so that the humans can have more time to do more, right? That's effectively what our mission is. I'd never want to walk into a building that just runs with machines, especially one as a hospital. I want to work with people. I want to be involved with people. I want to be looked after as a patient by people. I just want them to use tools to make their jobs easier and faster, and that I get the best care that I want. So we are constantly trying to solve these challenges. You know, the elevators are our biggest problem. And when we do, because we have some things in the work that I'm not going to talk about right now, but we have some ways that we're, you know, making proprietary systems to solve that problem. But I've seen companies all over the world do incredible things. I've seen companies in China build their own elevators for robots and spend like $1 million to do that just because they don't want to deal with the elevator companies. I've seen, you know, companies use solutions like on the ceiling and on the outside of the building, where they're actually have rails and systems where they're moving entire compartments, you know, outside of the building because they can't get into the elevator system, or they don't have the permission to, or it's just not legal, or whatever the cases are. So the problem is that when you build a building like a hospital, it's a 10 to 20 year project. And if you were going to open a hospital today, that means that you started planning to do it in 1995. So in 1995, nobody thought about robots, nobody thought about machines, nobody thought about this being a problem. And that cycle is where you're sort of, you know, struggling the most, is that you're getting into a building that was not prepared to be enabled for machines, and you have to sort of crowbar your way into doing that. But if you do solve that problem, the benefits are exponential. I mean, to give you some statistics, right? The very first hospital that we automated, the delivery time for medicine, you know, and it's patient-specific drugs, right? So it's stuff that, you know, a prescription is sent now, a doctor says, you know, give this person whatever drug, you know, X, and they send a request to the pharmacy. That delivery would take anywhere from 2 to 6 hours. And once we put our robots in, it took anywhere from 6 to 8 minutes, right? Because the machines obviously are just working all the time, right? And we were able to reduce the delivery time by like 90%. It was a huge improvement, and that hospital is still in our network today. And we've seen the same result in multiple different places. We've seen hospitals go from 2 hours to 6, 7 minutes. The improvement is dramatic, right? So it's a no-brainer. It's like you need to have these machines. These machines bring you so much benefit. But the barriers to actually get that right is all centered around the elevator systems. And we're very, very focused this year on trying to solve this problem and collaborate with the manufacturers, because they've started to realize that actually there is a great opportunity here, and we need to be more collaborative, and we don't need to be as, you know, sort of barrier centric around our business model. There's more to be made if we can collaborate than if we just, you know, close the front door and don't let you in. So, yeah, we are working very, you know, focused this year on achieving this, because it is the biggest problem that the whole industry is experiencing.
Steve, this is fascinating. Actually, I think the answer is C-3PO in Star Wars, with the special kind of tiny hand that manages to operate the elevators. But of course, you consider that, no doubt.
Are we actually
And so,
We had a robot arm pressing the buttons on the panels, and we were told that it was illegal, so that we had to take it out. It wasn't a functional problem; it was just illegal because the law for that state was written in 1985,
Yeah.
and we've updated it since.
And it
So,
says on there, human can operate
pretty
an
much,
elevator.
yeah.
Maybe even a child was illegal. I don't know. Or what was
Yes.
the age where you suddenly can operate an elevator? But anyway, that's a fascinating discussion. My question is, I understand there must be some hospitals, or most hospitals will say, yeah, it makes sense. It's a no-brainer, as you said. We want to start saving now. Let's do it. But in which case, if it's so like clear and an easy case to implement it, no doubt there are some competitors. And as you operate on multiple continents, as you mentioned, you based in Singapore originally, but now moving all around the place, from the US to all over the planet. So maybe could you share some of your takeouts from the sales process, like the how do you sell to hospitals? What are your experiences? How long it takes? Do you sell to management, or do you sell to personnel, or do you sell to like the company that runs the infrastructure? And what are the differences between, say, the North American hospitals versus Europe versus Asia? Or whatever, because it must take a long time. Even
Oh,
if
yeah.
the hospital says yes, then in Europe they need to do this like call for proposals, like invite everyone. It's a public process, takes ages. Then there is legal battles, etc. So is it the same all around the world, or do you have
Yeah, that is a very, very, very good question. And I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to frame it around the industry, but also try to give some advice because I've sold to many different kinds of industries, all different kinds of technology. And the way that we've been able to, move as quickly as we have, and we could move 10 times faster if you ask me, but the way that we've been able to move at the speed that we have is because of the principles that you apply to the sales process, right? Firstly, healthcare is defined into two buckets in a sense, right? There's public and private. Right, there are state-funded, state-run hospitals. There are private-run hospitals. Private hospitals move much faster because there is obviously a lot less oversight and committees and regulations around the capital because it's not public money, right? It's private funds. So ho private hospitals will naturally be a much faster process than public. What you always need to remember is that while you are solving a problem for a user. Right. This could be, a pharmacy technician, it could be a nurse, it could be a radiologist, it could be whoever, whichever sort of role that you're solving your problem for, they are not your decision maker. Right. They're never the people who are actually going to let that person have that tool. There's always a chain of command and a death by committee, effectively, in every hospital. And you need to understand right from the beginning all the moving parts to getting a yes. What does a yes look like? Right? Who has to be involved in this conversation? Because if you do not involve every single person and all of their egos at the same time, your project will never go anywhere. Right? This is unfortunately the situation. Because in a situation like a hospital that's constantly moving under high amounts of pressure, doesn't have time to stop and create innovation, and creates these committees and silos and operations and can be thousands and thousands of people, it's very difficult to understand the roadmap to a yes. So I would always start with who are the people that need to say yes for this to happen, right? While I'm trying to solve the problem for, let's even take the example of the cleaner, right? I'm trying to make the cleaner's life easier who has to, mop the floor. That's the janitor, the custodian, whichever sort of the term is. Well, that person isn't the one who's going to sign the contract and buy the product from me or, buy the service from me. It's their boss. Is their boss actually working for the hospital? Are they a subcontracting company? Right? That's the very first thing. Because in a lot of hospitals, there are a lot of subcontractors. There are, some departments run exclusively by subcontractors. So here in the US, most of the food and beverage, all the meals that are made every day, are run by external companies. In Europe, it's not like that. Everything's internal. So decide, is your decision maker internal or external? If that decision maker is there, who else in other subsequent departments needs to be involved? You know, we sell robots, so IT has to be involved. If IT is not involved from day one, they will derail your project for whatever reason that they want to, and they will delay your project from 1 month to 6 to 2 years. I've had conversations which baffle me, right? Where we're on a call with a pharmacy director. Pharmacy director is struggling, doesn't have enough staff to deliver, you know, medication. She's, you know, constantly inundated. People are working double shifts, you know, huge, huge crisis problem. And they want the machines because, you know, they need the help. So the next call goes to IT, and IT says, unfortunately, we can't look at this project until next year. Because they have their own stack of problems, or their own stack of issues, or their own stack of things. They have their own committees, their own review process, their own. It has nothing to do with pharmacy. It's nothing to do with pharmacy's operation, but IT cannot work this in for you. And while this product is for specifically one department, the other department has to be involved, or you're not getting involved here. So find out from day one, immediately, who are the people that you need to get a yes from? In Europe, you need to get many yeses by many different departments, right? You have to get an RFP done. You have to go through lots of evaluation steps. You have to have multiple proposals from three different vendors. Even if there aren't three different vendors in a country, there are so many different requirements to do so. And subsequently, your sales pipeline or your sales cycle will go from 3 months that you hope it to be 3 years, right? Like it can go whichever way. In America, most hospitals that you're going to deal with are private. So your decision makers and your decision-making processes is very different. Some companies have to do, you know, public RFPs. Some companies make decisions internally. Some companies, you know, everyone has differences. And that's the thing. There is no secret formula. The formula is go backwards from the person that you're trying to solve. Who are all the people that have to say yes for him to get the thing that he needs? And then you'll map that out for every single different market. And we've seen that our sales cycle has reduced dramatically because we've used channel partners who understand these markets. So here in the US, we have a channel partner who understands pharmacy and who works with 400 pharmacies across the US and understands all the people involved for what needs to be done, right? So try to find a channel partner in your industry that understands the requirements of that market and can help you put the pieces together and share the profits with that person, right? Make a collaboration. I don't like zero-sum games. I don't like winners and losers. If you look at the landscape, there are hundreds of thousands of hospitals across the world, and less than 1% of them have robots of any kind. So who are you competing with? You're competing with the market and the market's opportunity, right? It's wide, wide open. So it's not about us competing with each other. It's about us finding ways to collaborate, to solve problems, and to shorten the sales so we can effectively make change and innovation happen faster. That's my advice. That's how we've been doing it. We've been leaning on channel partners, working back from this methodology. And we can do, I mean, I've seen a deal get signed in 2 weeks, right? Which is unheard of in healthcare. I've also, you know, spent a year working with NHS, trying to do a free pilot that we would pay for ourselves, and then IT derailed the whole project completely and nobody got their machines, right? And it was completely free. So you have many different moving parts. You have to be, the best thing to do is to play the numbers, right? If you need to close one hospital every quarter, you have to have a conversation with 20 at a time, because some are going to move fast, some are going to move slow, right? If you really want to be able to meet a sort of, you know, a growth trajectory that makes sense for your company, go far and wide. Have as many conversations as you can. Keep those consistency of your communication, and remember that the fortune is in the follow-up, right? Don't let conversations die. Be on top of that conversation. Make sure that everybody that needs to be involved is involved. You follow the process, you understand the requirements, and you keep engaging with your customer. Then you'll start to see your sales cycle will get shorter and shorter and shorter, and you'll become more and more successful over time.
Steve, fantastic. Actually, we should rename this podcast to Sales Course Workshop. Yeah, because this was invaluable insights and advices on how to make deals not only in robot spheres are, yeah, if I understood. So thank you. But for the part of our audience who are digital health entrepreneurs, could you please share what's your experience? Because you have the experience of implementation when all the yes is done. Like, there are still issues, like still like challenges. And do you have any like difference? Like, please share something. What is like in hospitality, like in as Tomas said, hospital, like in digital health? Are there any specific challenges that are related to digital health you faced with?
Yes, I mean, you have to be cognizant of the common questions, right? So if you're dealing with patient data, patient specific information, every conversation you should start with is how secure your data is, why you're using this data, and what your objective is. I think advice that I could give everyone when you're starting a conversation with, you know, four or five people on a call, a Zoom call, in person, whatever it is, take the first 5 minutes to frame the problem as to why everybody's here and what you're doing to solve this particular problem, right? So when you're talking about digital services, whether you want to use AI to, you know, increase prescription, you know, flow, or whether you're using it for drug discovery or whatever it is that you're trying to do, if you can constantly remind everybody of the problem that you're trying to solve, it moves a little bit faster. And especially in this digital space where we're trying to do things that's never been done before, right? You want to be the first one. You have to also acknowledge that you're going to be the first one to find all the problems. So I find that the best thing to do is to frame the problem every time you have a conversation with everyone in the room and try to guide to a meaningful outcome, right? That means that people will start to believe in your vision. They'll understand what you're trying to achieve, and they'll give you the feedback and the advice of how to move forward because they'll start to be invested in the same problem that you're trying to solve. You know, that's the advice I can give because I've met all the teams in the Celestinas program, and I've heard everyone's problems, and they're amazing opportunities, right? What guys are trying to do and what they're trying to solve is incredible. And I feel, you know, so empathetic to their challenge of trying to solve these problems, and the industry is just not necessarily moving at the rate that they would like them to. It is the nature of this problem, right? This is just the nature of this industry. The important thing to do is to remind everyone that you are doing something that's never been done before and that you want to create this, you know, this solution to this big problem, and constantly remind why this problem is so important as an opportunity and a motivation to try to get people to move things a little bit quicker, right? As soon as people get lots of investment into your problem as much as you have, then they become your evangelists, they become your partners, they become your collaborators, they don't become your customers. Right? They're your customers later. But what they are your team right in the beginning. So always take that as an opportunity. No matter how you're framing a digital service, try to get everybody to believe the problem that you're trying to solve right in the beginning.
Steve, you mentioned Celestinus, which is the startup program that we run with supported by InterSystems. And maybe some of our listeners are wondering, should I take part in these programs, like incubators, accelerators? Does it make sense? Is it not a waste of time? Should I be speaking to the clients instead of taking part in mastermind sessions and hanging out on Zoom calls? But maybe also for a company like yours that already has paying clients, it has product is there, and you know you have real business. What is the reason for you to still be taking part in such an incubation program?
Okay, that's a great question, and I will give you my experience as a startup founder, and I've been through a number of different accelerators, you know, in different industries and different companies as well. Accelerators are there to be an accelerant, right? They're supposed to help you move faster, right? But if you don't use the accelerator correctly, then you're not moving any faster. You're just wasting your time, right? I liked the Celestinus program and the offering for two different reasons. One is that there isn't a sort of an equity play. I don't have to give you a percentage of my business, or I don't have to pay for the acceleration program through some investment. There's no, you know, funny business here. It's really straightforward, transparent, and you're just trying to help startups get access to thought leaders, right? To people who understand these different parts of the industry and that you can have a meaningful conversation and they can share meaningful, solutions, technology, and experience with you. We were on calls with, teams from InSystems, from AWS, it was even from Novartis, and how would I get in front of somebody from AWS, right? Like, it's impossible, right? I can write every email in the world. There's no one who's going to read it, right? Like, especially individuals who are involved with startups or involved with, AWS credits or involved with the infrastructure. Like, I can meet somebody and, have a conversation with them, get their email, engage with them. And all I need to do is take an hour and a half of my day, sometime in 3 months. When you look at it, the value is incredible, because if I was to go and try to find that person at that company or this company or that company, or try to ask or look for someone who's a subject matter expert in, in HL7 fire records or whatever the case is, like, I'm spending tens of hours of my life trying to find that person, but instead I have a call with them next week in a workshop. It's incredibly invaluable to have access to those kinds of people, and to have it for free is amazing, right? So when all those things kind of factored for us, it was a no-brainer for us to join the accelerator, because we don't feel like we're giving up any part of our company. And I know that startup founders feel so like closely tight around their stock and how much value they give and what they give away, but ultimately at the end of the day, your company is worthless. You're just starting, right? Like, you're not a billion-dollar business. You have a, a dream that it's going to be a billion-dollar business, and I wish you luck, but today it's worth nothing, right? So take the opportunity where someone's giving you value for free and grab it with both hands. And when you have an opportunity where there's actually an accelerator who is exchanging capital for equity or whatever, make that decision with your team or by yourself as to whether the value is there. Because at the end of the day, when you're a startup founder, your time is so, so, so limited, right? You're going to run out of money sooner than you can imagine. So if you can spend 10 hours a day in the most productive and efficient way with losing the most amount of time and money, that's the way to do it. And with a program like Senestinos, you can see the whole calendar for the next 3 months. I can plan all the conversations that I want to have at the right times, and it doesn't cost me anything. If somebody's setting up meetings for me for free, it's a dream, right? It's an absolute dream to have that ability. So I know that not every company can use the same sort of ideas like I'm speaking. Some companies are all different stages. But for me, I know the problem I'm trying to solve. I clearly know the kinds of people I need to talk to. I clearly have a problem and I have the questions that I need the answers to, and I don't have these people to ask these questions to. And ChatGPT is probably going to tell me some rubbish answer if I use it. So I found the best value in the program just by the connections, right? And being able to talk to subject matter experts. And also, talking to other startups who have, opportunities, contacts, networks, all of that is the most valuable thing. Because when you're starting up, you need friends, right? You need really good friends who know what they're talking about and can give you the best advice. And that's what I think the program gives you more than anything else.
Thank you, Steve. This is fantastic. So can I join Celestino now? So I want to apply immediately. Thanks for sharing this. So maybe the conclusion, we get to the end of our amazing podcast, that we don't want to stop, to be honest. Could we refer, please, to the early stage entrepreneurs, or those entrepreneurs that are just thinking to become entrepreneurs, but they already are? Especially maybe in digital health or just in general, what would be your advice, whether to go for this startup journey or if go to what to expect? Can you share anything from the level where you are?
I think the important thing to remember is that it's not the big that eat the small, it's the fast that eat the slow, right? You need to move faster than everybody else, because if you're not moving faster, you're dying. Right, and you will die. And it's so important for you to frame a problem that's worth solving, right? And that you can actually solve in a, in a finite amount of time. Startup entrepreneurs are like the most energy filled people, right? Like, they have immense amount of energy. They'll work 20 hours a day. They'll pour their blood and soul into this company for however long they take. And, they're so passionate around trying to do this, but they don't really have direction, right? So they're applying all this energy in every direction possible to see what sticks and what works. And that doesn't necessarily work all the time. That's actually probably the most risky way to do it. The important thing to do is to take the problem that you're trying to solve, right? Frame it very well. Talk to 20, 30 people if this is actually a problem worth solving, and that 20 or 30 people would buy it, right? And would they buy it in the next 3 or 6 months? Because if you're going to go down this road of starting a business from day one, you've got a runway, right? I love this word runway because it's so important to realize like you have 6 months until you're out of money and you're dead. You have to prove that something works in 6 months, or no one's going to give you any more money to make the next 6 months work. So frame the problem, condense it to its smallest amount of parts, find 30, 50 people who want to buy it, right, as soon as possible, and try to sell it before you kind of build it, right? Like, don't take anybody's money yet, but ultimately know that if, hey, if I built this, or if I gave you this output, or if I was able to take your data and output this result, or if I was able to build this tool for you, or if I was able to deliver your medicine from your pharmacy to your to your patients in 10 minutes or less, would you buy it? Would it be something that you would want to buy? And is it something that you want to buy now or this year or in the next 5 years? Like, ask the questions and make sure that you know the questions you need the answers to. And then also have the questions for yourself. Are we moving in the right direction? Are we wasting our money? Are we going in the right direction with this opportunity? Does this partnership make sense? Does this opportunity make sense? Are we over-engineering a problem that doesn't exist? Have we really built an MVP, or have we built something that nobody wants, right? These are the questions you have to be really hard on yourself about. It's really important to get mentors and, advisors around you who can hold you accountable, because you usually push the problems away on the passion that you're trying to solve, and that you're trying to be this champion out there, solving the thing, and you're the entrepreneur who left his job and you're, taking on the world. And that's amazing. But if you spent 6 months of your life and you got nowhere, you did nothing for nobody, right? Like, you need to be very focused with your time, very focused with your resources, and really focused on solving one problem very well. And once you get that right, it's very easy to copy and paste, right? It's very easy to scale up. But if you haven't solved the first problem right in the right amount of time, what makes you think that you're going to be able to solve it in another 6 months or another 2 years? Right? You have to be able to manage your expectations, manage your customers' expectations, condense everything to its basic first principles, and start from there. And if you succeed there, you will have so much energy, momentum, and partners and support that you'll be able to solve the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, and you'll build momentum, right? We think that energy, like all of our startup energy, is just going to translate into ultimate success. No. You take a little bit of steps. And you start to crawl before you start to walk. You start to walk before you start to run. Everything takes momentum to build. So first start with the first problems, the first things, and just build from there constantly. And you will be able to see clearly the road that you're going to follow, and you'll have a full direction, and you'll feel motivated to keep moving every day. But if you just throw all of your energy out in every direction, and you don't be critical of your time and your effort, and you don't hold yourself to account, you're just going to waste your time and wake up one day, you spent all your money and you didn't solve anything yet.
Well, really, Steve, this is probably ultra mini MBA that you are now we are providing with your help. Actually, you do all the work. We are just so happy to have invited you to upgrade our listeners in terms of their entrepreneurial skills. So that's been amazing. Thank you for that. My main takeouts, I especially like the expression a roadmap to yes. So when you are doing business with the hospital, make sure to map the roadmap to yes, identifying every single person you'll be expecting a yes from in your journey to a successful sales. So that's one thing. Then I like the fast eat slow as a takeout. So if you are small, don't worry, but you need to be fastest out of the crowd, and be ready for common sense like questions. Does it make sense? Is it something that helps with those stupid tasks? So that's I think that's important to identify like the stupid strenuous bits in the workflow of hospitals. And if you are into robots, maybe some of the hospital directors and management are listening. So make sure to give Steve a drop him a line, give him a call, because there is, I feel after this episode that there isn't a better partner for you if you aren't into robots in hospitals than Steve from Control Robotics. So and if you are, if, by any chance, if you are looking for investors, Steve, we didn't ask, but for your next maybe round, if we have investors, VC fund managers listening, they might be interested to have such a great robot company in their healthcare portfolio. What do you say?
Yes, of course. I mean, we've done some pretty impactful deals this year, strategic partnerships, predominantly in North America. And, you know, we've got a very strong pipeline of hospitals to service. And, you know, we need support and resources to do so. So, yes, we are looking for investment right now. We're in the middle of a fundraise. And, you know, we're working with, you know, some of the top 10 IDNs, the networks of hospitals in the US right now. We've really solved some critical problems. We're getting buy-in. And, you know, we've found product market fit, right? We feel very confident in making that statement. So anyone wants to talk to us about the round that we're raising, please feel free to reach out. We're happy to have a conversation.
I'm sure there will be plenty. We've seen deals happening live during our broadcasts. And Yevgeny, I'm so excited about robots in hospitals. I just next time I visit a hospital and there'll be no robots, I'll just directly make them reach out to Steve to change this. What do you reckon?
Same on my side. So now with every my hospital visit, this will be my first word. actually, and also what I liked, what my take is from your insightful sharing today, that in the end of the day, you said that there is something easy in an entrepreneur journey. So I noticed that, but still it's a tough thing, but of course, no doubt it's a very exciting way of living, of life, like a lifestyle. So this is what we want our listeners and entrepreneurs follow. And Steve, again, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. Super sure that it is invaluable for the audience. Yeah.
Thank you guys so much. I appreciate it. This was a great conversation, and I'm very, very happy to share our journey and our story.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone who's listened for over an hour to great advice from Steve from Control Robotics. So this is a Venture Vitals podcast by Celestinus. Make sure to follow us. And I'm looking forward to our next episode. So thank you, guys. And do good and do it well, as our motto goes.
With robots now. Yeah.
Yes, with robots.
Bye.
Amazing. Thank you.